Hello, and welcome to the Comic Shape My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week I'll be talking about Batman, The Brave and the Bold, number 7, Blackest Night, Tales of the Corps, number 3, Detective Comics, number 855, Fantastic Four, number 569, Justice League of America, number 35, Madame Xanadu, number 13, Superman, number 690, Unknown Soldier, number 10, Wednesday Comics, number 4, and Wonder Woman, number 34. Of course, these are all from this week, July 29th, 2009. First up is Wednesday Comics, number 4. I'm going to get this out of the way first because I don't have much in the way of substance to say about it. Not that I didn't enjoy it, it's just that every week I feel like I'm saying the same things. I still have no idea what's going on in the Wonder Woman strip. I still like Hawkman and the Flash and the Batman strip and, of course, Strange Adventures and Commandy. I still think Teen Titans has some washed-out, muddy art and overly familiar story. I still think Batman and Green Lantern would make fine newspaper strips in their own right. And I will say, though, that the Hawkman strip, I'm really impressed with the new style that Kyle Baker has brought to this strip. And this week brings in some computer-generated art, especially on the in the outer space scenes. Baker's also expanding the scope of the strip to show that Hawkman is firmly within the rest of the DC universe, with Hawk Girl and Batman making cameos. I was a little confused by the Flash strip because it didn't seem to connect up to last week's, but I read it a couple times, and you know what can I say? I'm a little slow, no pun intended. Next up is Fantastic Four, number 569. It features, as the back cover indicates, the final showdown with the Marquis of Death and the Wedding of the Thing. Spoiler alert, only one of those things actually happens within the issue. I guess it depends on how you define the terms. The issue was plotted by Mark Millar, or Mark Miller, script by Joe Ahern, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, penciled by Stuart Immonen, inked by Wade von der Grauwbacher and Scott Hanna. And this is an issue and a story and probably an entire creative run, which, I don't know. I've never been a huge fan of Mark Millar. He started off this run, and most of his run on Fantastic Four has been penciled by Brian Hitch, who I like better than Millar, but he's done better work as well. Anyway, this issue starts out with the FF fighting countless multiversal counterparts of themselves, facing the question of whether to kill the Marquis of Death rather than let him spread more evil across the multiverse, and witnessing the battle between, you know, the Master and the Apprentice, as it were, where the Marquis of Death and Dr. Doom fight each other using essentially whole universes. It's the kind of thing where everybody who comes on Fantastic Four emphasizes one or two things, probably both. One, that the FF are the Marvel's first family. They emphasize the love between Reed and Sue, the rivalry between Ben and Johnny, Ben's friendship with Reed, Sue's sibling relationship with Johnny, all the family dynamics that go into this book. And the other thing they emphasize is the need to live up to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's original sort of mind-blowing 100-odd issues. I mean, Stan and Jack introduced Galactus, the Silver Surfer, the Inhumans, the Impossible Man, Dr. Doom, the Mole Man, Claw, the Black Panther. You know, that's just off the top of my head. And Mark Millar especially felt the need, I think, to come in and say, well, I can come up with ideas, not necessarily to rival or surpass Lee and Kirby, but to compete with them. And it's been a lot of superficialities, I've thought. It ends with, I mean, he threw in, you know, Johnny Storm fronting a rock band and dating a supervillainess, the descendants of the Fantastic Four and the Hulk, well, an older Hulk, becoming the new Defenders, and, you know, all this ostensibly crazy stuff. And it doesn't really seem to have amounted to a whole lot. I mean, I remember Mark Waid's and Mike Wieringo's run on Fantastic Four. I'll remember that, I think, a lot more than I'll remember the concepts that Millar and Hitch introduced here. And one of those concepts, apparently, is the thing, finding a new girlfriend and getting engaged to her, and the whole run, well, I won't say the whole run, but a lot of the run building up to their wedding, and, you know, the sort of standard, well, what's it going to be like being married to a superhero trope. And I'm reading this issue, and I'm thinking, well, are they really going to go through with it? Because on one hand, Marvel is not quite as bound to tradition and sort of the proper thing to do as DC is. If this were a DC book and, you know, Clark Kent were getting ready to marry Cat Grant or Lana Lang, I'd think something was fishy. In Fantastic Four, though, you know, Johnny Storm married Alicia Masters 20-odd years ago. So there's kind of a precedent for Ben not winding up with Alicia. And that notwithstanding, I still was never convinced that Debbie, his erstwhile fiance, was ever going to be in this book on any kind of permanent basis. So I wasn't too surprised by the ending. I was surprised by the, and not in a good way, I might add, by the rationale for the ending. And it seemed rather, morbid, and even out of character for it to have played out like it did. And maybe Mark Millar means it as a commentary on women in refrigerators or sexism in superhero comics generally, but I don't know. It doesn't come off as enlightened as that. It comes off more like, here's a clever way to get out of this plot and inject some pathos into my last issue. On the plus side, I always enjoy Stuart Immonen's work. This is a lot more traditional. Well, he's filling in for Brian Hitch, so it looks a lot more like Brian Hitch than it does, say, like Next Wave. In fact, it looks a lot, well, not a lot. It looks more like his work for DC back in the early 90s on Legion of Superheroes and the Superman books than it does Next Wave. So maybe, you know, Next Wave could have been a departure for Immonen too, of course, but I don't know. Anyway, that's it for Mark Millar on Fantastic Four, and Vaya con Dios, I guess. Speaking of flagship team books which have seen better days, here's Justice League of America number 35, written by Len Wein. I'm not sure how to do that. Penciled by Tom Derenick and Pal Roderick's, excuse me, and inked by Mario Alcuiza, Rob Hunter, Walden Wong, and Dan Green. And the JLA book has been through a pretty rough patch pretty much ever since, well, for the last 3 years, I think, the JLA book has been sort of struggling to find itself. And this creative team is not going to be the permanent one. They're just sort of playing out the end of Dwayne McDuffie's tenure and setting up James Robinson and Mark Bagley to start in a couple of months. But this is a solid issue. I enjoyed it. It seems like whenever you need to sort of reboot or set up a new status quo for the Justice League, you bring in the Royal Flush Gang. So here's the Royal Flush Gang knocking over a casino. And it's a motley crew of Justice Leaguers who confront them, including Vixen, the female Dr. Light, Plastic Man, and Firestorm. Oh, and Red Tornado. And, you know, I give Red Tornado a lot of grief, but he's really not that bad in this issue. I mean, as long as we're not dwelling on, you know, his carnal urges, I think he's fine. I'm not familiar with Mr. Roderick's work, but I've seen Tom Derenick a lot. He tends to be a utility infielder for DC, and he's a decent storyteller. I have problems with how he depicts anatomy. His characters tend to be rather bulky and barrel-chested and thick, generally, which doesn't always work. And his faces can get a little deformed at times. But maybe it's Mr. Roderick's influence, maybe it's the inkers, but I kind of didn't mind his work this time out. So all in all, a solid issue. Who knows whether this team will be back next month, but it's a decent story, and you know, maybe the ship is righted. I actually didn't find any credits box in Batman the Brave and the Bold number 7, but on the Johnny DC website it says it was written by Jay Torres and drawn by Jay Bone, so I have no reason to doubt that. It's a clever story involving Batman and the classic Doom Patrol, who've been kidnapped by a mysterious villain who everybody thinks is General Immortus, but he's imprisoned them in a way that is sort of inconsistent with General Immortus's M.O. Nothing particularly groundbreaking about the story, but it is pretty fun, as this series tends to be. The art, of course, is in the style of the Brave and the Bold cartoon, if a little more stylized even than that. And there's probably a reference per page at least to the classic Doom Patrol series, which I'm sure the target audience of this book will not get, but, you know, geezers like me, you can't avoid them. Next is Wonder Woman number 34, written by Gail Simone and penciled by Aaron Lopresti and inked by Matt Ryan. It picks up on a lot of threads that were left at the end of the Rise of the Olympian storyline, which ran for 8 issues and finished last issue. And it manages to connect that storyline pretty organically with this issue's new plot, which finds Wonder Woman and Black Canary in an underground cage match scheme being run out of Tokyo. It's an enjoyable issue. Of course, Gail Simone wrote Black Canary for many years in Birds of Prey, so the banter between her and Wonder Woman is very entertaining, feels very natural. But there are a couple of instances where Black Canary sounds like Miss Folky McFulkerson. At one point she says, "Pish tosh bagosh, it'll be a hoot." And next page she refers to Wonder Woman's, one of her distinguishing features as her rumpus magoo. So I kind of felt like I was listening to Marge Gunderson there for a couple of minutes. But that's all to the good anyway. The funny part of the story, of course, comes with Wonder Woman and Black Canary having to sort of glam it up to get into this cage match syndicate. And that leads to more jokes about superheroine fashion. The art is good as always. Aaron Lopresti makes Wonder Woman and Black Canary look exponentially more ridiculous in their glammed up outfits than they do in their regular superhero outfits, and that's not meant to be a slam against their regular superhero outfits. And perhaps most importantly, I think this issue is a good palate cleanser after the unrelenting grimness of Rise of the Olympian. The grimness hadn't completely gone away, but nice to see that everybody involved with Wonder Woman still has their sense of humor intact. Superman number 690 was written by James Robinson and Perry Perez. It's an odd issue because about half of it is a big fight between Steel and Atlas. It's a well-done fight for what it's worth. Steel gives pretty good, and it's not like Atlas just comes in and mops up the floor with him, so Steel comes across pretty well. But then the rest of the issue is filled with little vignettes which quite expressly tease upcoming storylines in other titles. The captions at the bottom of the pages read like, "To be continued in, you know, Magazine X." And these are things like Dr. Light and the Guardian have a play date with their kids in the park. There's a kind of confusing vignette involving Zatara and the Parasite and old DC character named Mark Merlin, or Mark Merlin, I should say. Still stuck on Mark Millar. And another vignette involving the Science Police, and another one involving a Green Lantern and a member of the Legion of Superheroes. So, I don't know. I mean, I know enough about the book and about DC to recognize who these characters are and where they fall in the grand scheme of things, but I don't know how I'd rate this issue on its own. I think the art is fine. Again, aside from that one little vignette where it involves shapeshifters, so that didn't help me try to figure out who was what and why they were doing what they were doing. It's fine. Nothing particularly earth-shattering, but, you know, again, this seems like sort of a transitory issue anyway. Next is Blackest Night, Tales of the Core number 3, the final issue in this month's Blackest Night tie-in miniseries. It was written by Peter Tomasi. The first story was drawn by Chris Samnee. Second story was drawn by Mike Mayhew. The third story is actually a black and white reprint of Blackest Night number 0 with what they call director's commentary. Imagine a DVD commentary track done in narrative captions or in caption boxes, and you'll get an idea of the scintillating insights which are revealed in the director's commentary. Honestly, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure, you know, at some point I will. The two main stories are both tales of the Green Lantern Corps, and they're tales of very familiar Green Lanterns. The first one, which is the Chris Samnee drawn one, is about Kilowog, who you'll know as the big, bulky Green Lantern drill sergeant who calls everybody Poozer. Apparently, when we meet him in this story, he's just been recruited into the Green Lantern Corps. His drill instructor is pretty expressly Arlie Ermey from Full Metal Jacket, and, you know, a handful of other roles in which he invariably plays a riff on the same kind of drill sergeant character, which made him famous in Full Metal Jacket, and, of course, which he was in real life. Anyway, Lantern Ermey, for that is what he is called in the story, turns out to be the source of the Poozer epithet. And as I say, when we first meet Kilowog in this story, I kept hearing him in the voice of David Hyde Pierce. So, evidently, Lantern Ermey had a profound effect upon young Kilowog, and not just because of what happens in this story. As for what does happen in the story, well, let's just say that I wasn't really thinking of Full Metal Jacket. I was more thinking of Stripes, and specifically Sergeant Hulka. This is a very by-the-numbers sort of mean drill sergeant leaves profound impression upon young recruit story. And since it did put me in mind of Sergeant Hulka, I was kind of hoping that Kilowog would initially adopt a more Bill Murray-esque approach to training recruits, but as we all know, it was not meant to be. The second story involves Aresia. How to describe Aresia? She's the Green Lantern who looks like a 13-year-old, or looked like a 13-year-old girl when she was first introduced, who was romanced fairly, or had a huge crush on Hal Jordan, which he reciprocated, despite the fact that she looked like a 13-year-old girl. And that was explained as being okay because people from her planet tend to look young. So, regardless of the fact that she looked like jailbait, that's okay because everybody from her planet looks like jailbait. In any event, Arisia's story involves her father, who was a Green Lantern before she was, and her uncle, who was also a Green Lantern. So Green Lanterning kind of runs in her family, yada, yada, yada. She gets to be a Green Lantern. No points for guessing how that happens. Again, it's kind of a by-the-numbers sort of thing, sort of daddy's little girl grows up to follow in his footsteps. And given that Blackest Night involves people's dead loved ones coming back to wreak horrible vengeance upon them, I can only guess that we'll be seeing Lantern Ermy and certain other Green Lanterns, ex-Green Lanterns, in the pages of that miniseries. So, I don't know. I mean, the thing about it is, I like Chris Samnee's work. I like Mike Mayhew. I wish they were just in the service of better stories. Next up is Madame Xanadu number 13. It's the third part of the Exodus Noir storyline. It's written by Matt Wagner with art by Michael William Kaluta. And Madame Xanadu, I think, is getting to be another one of those books where I just say the same sort of general, oh, I liked it a lot, it's really fabulous kind of thing, you know, every month. I will say that it's pretty suspenseful, even though there's no real suspense about whether Madame Xanadu will get out of the Spanish Inquisition alive, because clearly she's perfectly healthy in 1940. Although I will say that with her ungodly quote-unquote behavior back in the Inquisition days, she really should be expecting the Spanish Inquisition, just like I suppose many of you would have been expecting that joke. Kaluta's work looks great as usual. Wagner's script, likewise, is, you know, lively. He keeps things moving. There is a little bit at the end of, I don't know the term. I hesitate to call it sort of a step and fetch it dialogue for an African-American character. I mean, he gets the point across, and I don't know if I approve of it or not. It did take me out of the story a little bit, and it was probably a little too much, kind of in the, not quite as bad as when, say, Chris Claremont does dialect, but it was distracting, I'll just say that. Anyway, this storyline has two issues to go. I'm not really seeing the two plot threads converging, the Inquisition and the 20th century end of it, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless. And finally, it's Detective Comics number 855. The lead story by Greg Rucka and J.H. Williams III features Batwoman, and the co-feature is The Question, written by Rucka and drawn by Cully Hamner. We pick up with Batwoman where we left off last issue. She's confronting Alice, the head of the crime religion, and the lead story is essentially Batwoman escaping from Alice's lair. And I just, you know, again, with the last issue, with 854, you just kind of have to look at the opening sequence to understand what Williams is doing with the art. There are three panels, three big panels, I should say, but within those, Williams is using thin red lines, Alice's chest, and then Batwoman's mouth to really draw the reader's attention to those areas. They're almost inset panels. The effect isn't like an inset panel without, you know, quite so heavy a line. The colors by Dave Stewart really add a lot, and as I say, Williams, I mean, this is one of the best superhero, mainstream superhero books out there, and I don't know how far back you have to go to find a book not drawn by J.H. Williams that looks equally good. It's like, I don't know how much time he spends just on the thickness of a line or the depth of shading. Just look at something like the third panel is just a close-up of Batwoman, but there are, you know, several shades of gray that help define her contours or the wrinkles in her costume, even the shadow on her face. And things like Alice has pale white skin, Batwoman's skin is pretty pale. It's just a beautiful book, and I do not have the vocabulary really to do it justice. Much of the question feature is an extended fight sequence, which Cully Hamner pulls off pretty well. Honestly, my biggest problem, and it's not much of one, with the new question, or with the Renee Montoya question, since she's not all that new anymore, is that I have a hard time, I'm not sure that she's gotten a hold on her wardrobe yet. Essentially, the question's costume is this full face mask and a gas which changes her hair color. And by full face mask, I mean it's flesh colored, so it looks like she has no face. And with this issue, you know, since it's mostly her beating up on some goons, I think Hamner portrays that pretty well. I mean, not just the choreography of the fight, but makes her look like a different person, which I guess is the point of any disguise, duh. But the plot itself, she's trying to track down a missing woman, and the last couple of pages of the co-feature lead her further in that regard. It ends on a cliffhanger, so not much to that development. And as I say, the major part of the feature is the fight. But it's, you know, pretty enjoyable. It's probably comparable to something like Burn Notice or, I can't think of another example, but you get the idea. So all in all, still a good issue. Again, the Batwoman feature is just phenomenal, thanks to Williams. And, you know, Ruck is a big part of that, too. I don't mean to slight him. Certainly, he's been with Batwoman longer than Williams has, and it's a good package all around. And with that, we'll bring this week's podcast to a close. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I will see you next week.